Auto parts, oil, and inevitably some smog. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, December 29th. Good to have you with us. Investor Carl Icahn has sweetened his offer for the auto parts and service company Pep Boys. The company's full name, by the way, Pep Boys, Manny, Moe, and Jack. Icahn's new offer of $1 billion is the latest in an ongoing bidding war with Japanese tire maker Bridgestone. Marketplace's Amy Scott looks into what's so attractive right now about the business of fixing up cars.
The average car on the road right now is a record 11 and a half years old. Cars are better made and people have held on to them longer in a shaky economy. IHS analyst Mike Wall says that's good news for the auto parts and service business. By 2020, he predicts 76 million vehicles will be at least 16 years old.
So those vehicles out there are going to need repairs. So you're going to see a lot of the do-it-yourselfers still out there repairing their vehicles. And, of course, the service shops remaining busy.
Pep Boys benefits from both. It sells parts and service in more than 800 stores around the country. The improving job market and low gas prices have also been a boon to the business. Auto analyst Brian Sponheimer with Gabelli & Company says people are commuting more and putting more wear and tear on their cars, and they've got extra money in their pockets.
People are putting a little more money into maintenance that had been deferred.
But Pep Boys' two suitors want different things from the company. Jefferies analyst Brett Jordan says Bridgestone has its eye on the service side of the business, the part where someone else fixes your car for you. Jordan says Bridgestone wants to expand the more than 2,000 service centers it already operates, mostly under the Firestone brand.
As cars have become more complicated, the growth in do-it-for-me service is certainly there and driving fairly attractive valuations.
Meanwhile, Jordan says it's the retail side Carl Icahn is after to combine with the Auto Plus parts chain he bought earlier this year. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
When we talk about the price of crude oil on the show, we're usually talking about Brent, or WTI, also known as West Texas Intermediate. We'll go shorthand and call WTI the American price. For years, it's sold for less than Brent, except now it's totally caught up. For what that tells us, we're joined by Marketplace's Scott Tong from our sustainability desk. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Adrienne.
So talk me through these different oil prices.
Well, there are actually dozens of different prices for dozens of kinds of oil around the world. There's Algerian light, Iranian heavy, Nile blend. It's like a craft beer list.
And you know all of these by heart, right?
Sure. But to make life easier for me and the traders out there, there are two main benchmarks. Brent is a blend of oils from the North Sea, and it reflects generally kind of global supply and demand. And WTI, West Texas Intermediate, is a similar kind of oil produced in Texas that reflects the North American marketplace. Now keep in mind, most buyers and sellers, they never touch the oil. It's not like home buying. It's more like home flipping, right? You're investing in something.
Okay.
Now, for several years, WTI and Brent, the prices were pretty similar until the American price, WTI, went $20 lower about 3 or 4 years ago. And these prices, they kind of tell you what's happening in the market. So U.S. production started taking off right around then because of fracking. It put out lots of oil that couldn't get out of America. Energy analyst Chris Nelder at the Rocky Mountain Institute, he told me there weren't enough pipelines to get the oil out and U.S. exports were banned.
Some of that has been effectively landlocked. So when those refiners cannot use any more of that particular grade of oil coming out of fracking operations, which is a light, sweet grade of oil, then it can create a bit of a glut.
So that's what was pushing the WTI price down. But
yep.
Today we're seeing that this differential, the spread between Brent and West Texas Intermediate, has basically disappeared. And I know this sounds kind of in the weeds for us, but why is this interesting? What's this tell us?
Well, it is in the weeds, but these prices tell us what's happening in the market. And so what's happened in the market the last year, a little bit more than a year, is oil prices have crashed. And for the highest cost drillers, the expensive drillers who can't make any money at these prices, that's the American and the Canadian producers. So American, North American production went down, And so the glut shrank a little bit, and then Congress just repealed the export ban. And so oil traders now think that'll get rid of the glut entirely, and that's why you've seen that this differential totally go away. Now, we'll see if the U.S. actually does export a lot of oil. That's a big debate for now. But we see that spread, that differential, is now gone.
If you allow these exports of oil, if this happens, does that mean oil is going to become a fully global market? Will we still need all these different prices and distinctions?
You know, Adrienne, it's always kind of been a global market, but now even more so. We've just removed another barrier. So one distinction a lot of economists find a lot less important is the notion of energy independence, right? If one country decides not to sell to us, we can always now get it from somebody else. And by the way, the U.S. still imports a lot of oil. And if there's some kind of a price shock somewhere around the world, we all pay it. You know, whether you're a country that pumps a lot of oil or you pump zero, nobody's immune to a price shock anymore. Now, there are benefits of pumping more oil. It helps your trade balance. It creates a few jobs. But as far as the big shocks, domestic oil versus foreign oil doesn't matter as much as it used to.
So if we're all living in our oil world together, why are prices at the pump here in California so different from prices in other parts of the country?
Well, now we're talking about gasoline, right? Oil makes gasoline. So after oil goes into the refinery and it comes out, it's transported. So that goes into your local retail price. And then it's taxed by your state or your county. And then there are local rules to emit less smog in some places or less CO2 in some places. So those are the big reasons that vary so much across the United States. But underneath all that, Adrian, is still global supply and global demand in the wholesale price of crude.
Marketplace's Scott Tong. Thanks.
Okay, you're welcome.
On Wall Street today, consumers were confident and traders were too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. More consumers are abandoning, or at least trying to abandon, processed foods, which means some big food companies have to rethink their business. They got to speed up their innovation process and come up with foods that the more health-conscious consumers out there want to eat. Marketplace's Annie Baxter spent some time at a General Mills sample table to see how all that's working.
About once a week, teams of marketers and researchers from General Mills can be found lurking around in places like this. It's a grocery store in the Twin Cities, and a General Mills team is handing out food samples in little plastic cups.
Would you like to try a crunchy bean snack made to satisfy your salty craving?
Oh, I shall.
The product is roasted broad beans, also known as fava beans. Right. It's getting developed under the Food Should Taste Good brand. And the General Mills team wants to find out if it fits the bill as the kind of protein-rich, healthy snack consumers seem to want these days. So they ask shoppers a lot of questions.
Have you heard of fava beans?
No.
No. Okay.
Mm-mm.
Apparently that unfamiliarity is not a stumbling block.
See, now this gives me the impression it's healthy, right?
Because it's just a bean?
It's a bean, yeah.
Awesome.
It's not made up crap. You know?
This outspoken shopper, Betty Lindstrom, goes on to complain about the kind of food she doesn't like. And her example is Cheerios, which just happens to be a General Mills product.
They're adding so much sugar to foods that makes me just, you know, so angry. I think I get like Cheerios for my husband and find out it's full of sugar, you know.
Awkward, but the marketing manager just rolls with it. No one from the team defends the company. In fact, they don't even identify themselves as General Mills. And it's probably because in a lot of ways, the effort here is to stop being so General Millsy, as in the General Mills that's fighting a backlash against big food and having a rather tough time of it. The other baggage they're trying to dump is the way the company, as a, you know, lumbering multinational food conglomerate, has traditionally taken years to develop new products.
You know, how do you compete with companies that don't go through all, you know, the hierarchy?
Carlos Torelli is a marketing professor at the University of Minnesota. He says small firms have the nimbleness to get products to market faster, and big food companies like General Mills are trying to act more like them, more entrepreneurial.
Instead of, you know, the old process of going in stages, you know, development of concept and then trying to develop a test market with as a representative sample.
And the thing is, those smaller, nimbler companies are increasingly big competitors. Heidi Emanuel, the VP of Strategy and Innovation at General Mills, says those little companies used to have a hard time getting off the ground, and that's just not the case anymore.
Everything can be outsourced. You can
hire people to do your manufacturing, your distribution, your R&D, your sales. Really, you can be a two-man show and outsource almost everything.
Back at the grocery store, a lot of customers seem to like the bean snack.
I think that's perfect.
Oh, we like perfect.
There are a few notable exceptions.
I didn't want to say it tasted like salted tree bark because I don't want to be too offensive, but it just didn't do it for me.
Comments like that don't seem to faze Liz O'Hara with consumer research at General Mills. She says her team wants to hear about the product's flaws.
We don't want us to be like this most perfect thing and be married to that execution, because then we can come out here and learn what about it's incorrect, because it will be wrong.
And in a debrief session afterwards, the team members even conclude that they need to gather more negative feedback in the next round.
Look for more rejectors to interview. All right. Peace out, friends.
In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter from Marketplace.
How much should a drug cost? It's one of the most pressing questions in healthcare right now. Prescription drug spending has spiked in the last 2 years. The public says controlling prices is a top priority. That's as the FDA has sped up the process of approving drugs, putting more pressure on insurers to figure out just how valuable new pharmaceuticals actually are. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein takes a look at one new and expensive class of drugs.
New drugs can literally save a person's life. Dr. Jay Edelberg believes a new drug his company, Sanofi, has developed may end up doing just that by lowering cholesterol, what he calls LDLs.
The incredible relief that so many of our patients have had, knowing that for the first time in their lives, or for the first time after a heart attack, their LDLs are actually a treatment goal, has really been stunning.
Enter new drugs known as, and you may start hearing this name a lot, PCSK9 inhibitors. Earlier this year, the FDA approved Sanofi's drug and one from Amgen. Each company has listed prices running at more than $14,000 a year. But clinicians say for select people, this may be their only option.
It sounds like it should be a slam dunk.
Dr. Stephen Pearson runs the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review.
But we don't know yet for sure whether they will reduce heart attacks and strokes. And in the meantime, they're also very expensive.
To Pearson, these drugs raise essential questions. Namely, as the FDA approves more medication with less data, how do we determine a drug's actual value? While the product is already on the market, it may take 24 months before Sanofi can say whether someone's less at risk for a stroke or heart attack. Peter Pitts is an FDA consultant.
The price can't be considered a stagnant proposition. It needs to be a vibrant living thing.
Pitt says what's new now is that insurers and drug makers must accept that if the drug's working, reward it. If it's not, don't pay for it. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up,
This program has really seen the ups and downs of the budget cycle over the decades. And nevertheless, it has survived.
A look at the C-130 cargo plane, the military's half-century-old workhorse. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 192 points, 1.1% to close at 17,720. The Nasdaq climbed 66 points, 1.3%, ending at 5107. The S&P 500 added 21 points, 1% to finish at 2078. Something to look forward to maybe next year. Real estate will get its own industry sector right alongside tech, finance, and so on, which means real estate index funds, which means real estate investment trusts. These trusts, called REITs for short, own office buildings, shopping centers, apartments, hotels. Take Sunstone Hotel Investors, 30 hotels with 14,000 rooms under brands like Marriott, DoubleTree, and Hyatt. Sunstone shares up 0.8%. Feldcore Lodging Trust, same deal, 48 hotels of various brands up 2.5%. In tech, the AAAs all gained today. Amazon up 2.7%, Apple 1.8%, Alphabet, ticker symbol GOOG or Goog, up 1.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note was up to 2.31%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is listener-supported, so please, to keep our coverage relevant and compelling, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st, and thanks.
You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. Beijing imposed its first ever red alert warnings for air pollution earlier this month. Schools and industries shut down, and restrictions were imposed on cars and trucks coming into the city. But it is not the most polluted place on the planet. The Indian capital, Delhi, now has that dubious distinction. So what's it like to live and breathe in all that smog and have your kids living and breathing in all that smog? Well, Justin Rowlett has been finding out. He moved there with his family earlier this year to be the BBC's South Asia correspondent.
We live in a house near the center. It's quite a leafy part of town. The family's having breakfast. I'm going to turn on a little air monitor I've bought. Set it to measure the really dangerous pollution, the microparticles that can travel really deep into your lungs, and now it is showing a reading of 457 micrograms per meter cubed. I'm just going to go outside. Here we go, and let's see if it's different out here. And it is, it's going up. Well, out here it's even higher, 503, so more than, what, 20 times the safe limit? And what worries me is the effect this is having on my four children. The pollution only gets this appalling in winter, when cold air acts like a lid, trapping smog over the city. Most Delhi residents have had to suffer the city's poisonous air for years. I've come to one of the respiratory wards in Delhi's biggest hospital, Ames, and virtually all the patients here have oxygen masks on. They've clearly got serious illnesses. 500 patients a day come here with lung problems. Dr. Randy Galeria is the top lung expert here, but he says air pollution isn't just a problem for the lungs.
These fine particles cause inflammation in the blood. The blood vessels become hardened, there's clotting, and therefore this leads to higher chance of heart-related problems and strokes. And therefore, chronic exposure to high levels of air pollution is a bigger risk than smoking, high cholesterol, and things like that.
One major study found half of Delhi's 4.4 million school children already have irreversible lung damage. Anumita Roy Chowdhury, executive director of the Centre for Science and the Environment in Delhi, says the source of the problem is the booming economy, and in particular the 1,400 new cars that are registered in the city every day.
What we needed were the stringent emission standards and regulations. Now we really need cleaner standards, and at the same time have a strategy in place to reduce the numbers on the road.
But already the authorities are suggesting if enforcing the new restrictions on cars causes too many problems, they'll be lifted. So the truth is, public action may be a while coming. And in the meantime, it's up to individuals to protect themselves.
That's the BBC's Justin Rowlett. The C-130 Hercules is the workhorse of the U.S. military. The transport plane is assembled at Lockheed Martin, just north of Atlanta in Marietta, Georgia. It's now the longest continually produced military aircraft. WABE's Stephanie Stokes went to Marietta and brings us the secret to the C-130's longevity.
When Lockheed designed the C-130 Hercules in the 50s, a company engineer, Kelly Johnson, said they'd be lucky to sell 100. Out here on the tarmac in Marietta, Lockheed Martin's Tony Fries is delivering number 2,500.
Here we are 60 years later, so we always are quite thankful that Kelly Johnson, a brilliant man,
got that one piece wrong. Okay.
That engineer, Johnson, was working on sleek reconnaissance jets. The Hercules, by comparison, is clunky, with large propellers, a heavy tail, and a belly big enough to fit a bulldozer. But that's been its secret to long life.
It's kind of like a coelacanth.
Richard Abulafia studies aviation trends for the Teal Group. His analogy for the C-130, if you're not familiar, is a sea creature that escaped extinction.
That ancient fish that was hauled up and, well, there it is, still alive. And it's alive for all the right reasons. It's really good at what it does.
What the C-130 does, simply, is cart things or people around for the military. So it's used for special operations, humanitarian relief, search and rescue missions. It can refuel other aircraft in flight. Sometimes it does coastal patrol.
Basically, it's a terrific jack of all trades. And since its success isn't based upon some kind of high-tech whiz-bang performance, like stealth or speed or anything like that, that basic design from the 50s is still quite relevant today.
Most military aircraft programs last 20 to 30 years before losing ground to new technology. With the Hercules, Lockheed Martin can just add technology to the same proven plane. And by the way, while the price can vary, the basic version of the latest model costs something in the realm of $70 million. With 60 years of production at the same facility, entire families in Marietta have been tied to the aircraft.
Can't get too close because we need eye protection.
At the C-130 plant, Kim Gunter is helping build the latest Hercules. His father, Gunter says, worked on the very first.
We've been on every one of them, so it is a neat plane, a cool plane, and I'm glad to be here working on it.
Back when Lockheed assembled multiple aircrafts in Marietta, the facility had 33,000 employees. Now, there are fewer than 6,000, mainly to work on the C-130 program. Living here, Gunter says he's seen the benefits.
The best thing that ever happened to Marietta was that C-130 coming over here and being built here. And it's good times, bad times with orders and stuff like that, but we keep selling them.
They keep selling them because the U.S. military relies on them on a daily basis. The Hercules, after all, has remained in production not only during conflicts going back to the Vietnam War, but after them, says Todd Harrison. He analyzes defense spending at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
And so, you know, this program has really seen the ups and downs of the budget cycle over the decades. And nevertheless, it has survived. And if you look at current plans, right now, we'll continue buying C-130s out through the late 2020s.
The plane also has an international market. As for the 2500th Hercules aircraft that we watched take off from Marietta, it was sold to the U.S. Air Force. And really, it too could end up anywhere in the world, depending on where there's a need. In Marietta, I'm Stephanie Stokes for Marketplace.
One of the big global stories this year has been the Syrian refugee crisis. The Obama administration announced plans to settle 10,000 Syrian refugees in the country next year. There have been debates in Congress on the screening process and how effective it is. Currently, refugees must pass extensive health and security checks. And then once they arrive, they have to build a life, jobs, apartments, bank accounts. As part of that process, they attend classes. Marketplace's wealth and poverty team went and sat in.
Hi, everyone. How are you today?
Yes.
You ready to talk about credit?
My name is Christopher Rhodes, and I am a cultural orientation coordinator for the Interfaith Refugee Immigration Service.
My question to you first is, when you come to this country now, right now, do you have any credit?
Correct.
You're correct. No, you have no credit.
Even people who have credit and credit cards in other countries don't know, for example, that when you come here, you have no credit. People coming here to this country are immediately signing up to cell phones and, you know, get an apartment usually, and your utilities and bills are enough to establish credit.
If you have really bad credit, they could refuse you. And if they don't refuse you, they can accept you, but you will have really high interest. So there's two bad options.
If you teach them the rudimentaries in the first couple of months, they're able to make a life for themselves. So yeah, economically, both for taxpayers and for the refugees themselves, it makes good economic sense.
My name is Joseph Balian.
Before this class, I thought that if you have a credit, you can buy without any thinking, and you can buy everything and no concern. But to be honest, after this class, I just changed my mind. I'm scared to use the credit card.
Getting a car is often in the first year or two something that they would really want, and that almost always needs a loan. At some point, you might want a house, in this country, you know, most people can only afford a house while they're working or both people are working, and you have a really long loan, like 30 years. You're done. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for coming. If you have any more questions, you can ask your caseworker, Alanush or Ruben or Rafi.
That piece was produced by Marketplace's Caitlin Ash. This final note before we go today, buried in the latest omnibus spending bill from Congress, plans to build a deep space habitat, one that might help NASA get a crew to Mars one day. Congress set aside $55 million for the space-worthy living quarters. It wants an update from NASA by the middle of next year and is pushing to have something ready to go by 2018. Space News reports NASA could be testing the habitat in the 2020s and actually using it to get to Mars in the 2030s. Which, as futury as it sounds, isn't all that far away. And that's our show today. Today, the Dow gained 192 points, 1.1%. The Nasdaq climbed 67 points, 1.3%. And the S&P 500 added 21 points, 1%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. And the senior digital producer is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll see you again tomorrow. This is APM.